All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, as I am each and every week. I just never change. There's never anybody different than me sitting in here, because even though they're fighting to get out of my head, I won't let them out. I won't let them out. Oh, one's slipping through now. Anyway, yes, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. We got a packed show today, and I'm very pleased to tell you that at the back end of the show, we're going to be joined by David Clennon, one of the few voices in Hollywood to take a stand against torture as promoted by the film Zero Dark Thirty. And we're going to be talking with David all about what's concentrated up in that and the response or lack of response that's happened in Hollywood. Actually, it's actually the response and the complicity that that entails, as well as the need for people to stand up and fight around that. And opening the show up, I'm very, very pleased to tell you that we are going to be joined by Maxime Pozdorovkin, who's co-director with Mike Lerner of the film Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer. And this movie won the World Cinema Documentary Special Award for Special Jury Award for Best Punk Spirit at the Sundance Festival this year. I met Maxime up at Sundance. We talked a while, and I thought it would be a really interesting film, a really compelling film. And I wanted to bring him on the show to share all this with you. Max, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, let's talk with people about the film. If you can give them a sense of what it's about, starting with why the title. The title being Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer.
Well, Pussy Riot, for people that may not know, are feminist art collectives who specialize in unsanctioned guerrilla performances in all sorts of public places, which they then, usually a day later, upload to YouTube as a video. And they got into quite a bit of trouble. They had some other fairly famous performances, but almost literally a year ago, on February 21st, they got in trouble for going into Russia's main cathedral, getting up on the altar, which is sort of the most sacred part of that cathedral, where women are not allowed to go, and then performing a sort of idiosyncratic prayer, which they call the punk prayer, for 40 seconds, asking the Virgin Mary, the Virgin, to chase, to rid Russia of Putin and to become a feminist. They were subsequently arrested, put on trial, and sometimes became the biggest news story in the world. So the film kind of follows through that story from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm. We're having a little bit of trouble. Your voice is going down, so if you could be conscious of keeping your voice up as you're talking, it'd be good. All right. Now, Max, here's one thing. In terms of this, the Pussy Riot movement, what developed as or emerged as a Pussy Riot movement, actually, was it really much of a movement before this incident in the church?
Well, there wasn't much of a Pussy Riot movement. The Pussy Riot movement came after the controversy over their arrest and the fact that they were charged with essentially a hate crime. It was hooliganism motivated by religious hatred. So what happens is Pussy Riot was formed on the day that President Medvedev announced that he would be returning, that Putin would be returning to power for a third term. And so in a way, that Pussy Riot fits into the larger opposition movement that culminated in several mass demonstrations in Moscow and other cities in Russia last year. So politically, the members of Pussy Riot come out are a part of that. I think that once the Pussy Riot story got out into the world, because they are an anonymous collective and they encourage people to do like they do, to dress up wearing these balaclavas, to write songs, to perform them, to do these guerrilla performances, there are people around the world that have taken up that cause and have also taken up their cause in terms of trying to get them out of prison and et cetera, and get them support and get them kind of international recognition of prisoners of conscience.
Here's the big question for me. That 40 seconds, which actually someone writing in The Guardian in Britain said that 40-second bit at the church may actually have been the greatest rock concert of the year. And I just kept thinking about this in terms of the repercussions of this. And in relation to what you're talking about, the movement, how did that 40 seconds, what was it that made Putin and the Russian ruling class and all of the various conservative forces, all this, the church, all of this stuff, what was it that sort of suddenly catapulted from, you know, even the fact that they that the state had not paid that much attention to Pussy Riot and that the developments in that before this 42nd concert, and yet everything came to a head with this 40 seconds inside the church. Why?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and one of the things that Mike and I both have said and have discussed is that, in many ways, since, you know, the members of Pussy Riot do see themselves as performance artists who were influenced by Moscow conceptualism and a movement in Vienna called Actionism, which is sort of a mix of direct action, direct political action, and artistic and performance art. In a way, these 40 seconds may be the most controversial piece of performance art in history, because if you think about the resonance that it had in terms of, you know, 100,000 believers in Russia coming to protest against these four girls, essentially, you know, if you compare it to other controversial pieces of art in history, whether it's Tiff Christ or Eve Klein or Joseph Beuys or Rite of Spring or Manet's Olympia, any of these things, the kind of broad public response has rarely been this strong. And, you know, back to your question of why this was, I think it was a lot of factors. I think that the main catalyst in the response, there were people who were inside the church, most of them working there, some just visiting, who were genuinely offended with what they were doing, particularly because they were yelling, "It's God, shit." That was the chorus of the song inside. And so they pressed charges against them. I think that it was spun out of control by Patriarch Kirill, who at the time was having some other kind of PR disasters. And he called a rally together amongst believers to protest against the girls. Then Russian television kind of picked up on it, and they were really quite vilified on several primetime television shows. But the reasons behind this are really interesting. I mean, part of it has to do with the resurgence of Russian Orthodoxy after 70 years of being in a sort of being persecuted and mitigated in all these various ways. Right now there is a resurgence, and they have a voice, and a lot of in the wake of the Pussy Riot performance, a lot of Orthodox fundamentalism has come to the surface. Another factor is that while they have been great, you know, conceptual and performance artists in Russia, Oleg Kulik, Nikolai Prigov, and others, the knowledge of performance art is quite limited as well. It hasn't had the same kind of resonance in the West. Same thing goes for punk, in that Russia, there have been some sort of punk bands, but Russia, the Soviet Union in the 70s, never had a punk rock moment. They never had a 1977 with God Save the Queen and all these things. So for mass audiences that are just first hearing it and first hearing of a punk prayer, there's also this kind of idea that this abrasive rock and roll is something that's really shocking in a way that it isn't in other places. And so that explains sort of a cultural shock on it. And then I think that because they had staged several anti-Putin performances before, it was really, really convenient for the government that there was sort of enough of a national will to prosecute the girls and to essentially put them on trial and charge them with a criminal offense as opposed to giving them an administrative fine.
Well, tell me this, Max. In relation to all this, one thing that really, and both in terms of some of the things that you showed in your film and other things that I've read in interviews with you and Mike, this question of, you know, this becoming this assault on Pussy Riot and on the women in particular that were arrested. And I should let people know, as you said, there were three people arrested, three young women arrested, Nadia, Masha, and Katya. And actually, so people know that while all three were convicted, Katya was actually managed to get out on appeal. Nadia and Masha are currently sitting in prison colonies serving 2-year sentences. You know, one of the things that came out in all this was this intense, I mean, I'm wondering about this, was there actually this effort to sort of the polarization in Russian society, where you had a lot of people that were just, you know, coming out and around the church in a mass political movement kind of way. And at the core of that was a lot of what seemed to be very hardcore misogyny.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the, I think that you picked up on one of the central elements, and actually Gracia's father, early on when I met him during the trial, we were just sitting in the courtroom, and, you know, the prosecution side and the defense side were facing one another, and he said this thing, which I think is very true, that there are two Russias which hate each other and really can't get along, and one is a more kind of conservative, traditional, also in some ways still communist-inflected Russia, and then one is a more Western, and is a more Western Russia, and I think that that comes together. And I think your point about the misogyny is also very, very important. One of the things, I think that there's a little bit, the girls' commitment to feminist practices has been lost in the emphasis given to the political side of the case. And one of the interesting things is that the Soviet Union had a first wave of feminism quite early, or actually Russia even before the Soviet Union, between 1905 and 1917, there was a very kind of progressive feminist movement. And out of the European nations, the Soviet Union became the first place where women had the right to vote, could easily obtain abortions and divorce. But then the second wave of feminism, which in this country we associate with people like Judith Butler and in the 60s and 70s, that really never happened in Russia. And the girls are both influenced by the first wave of feminism in Russia and also by the second wave Western feminism. And as a result, I think that Russian society remains a very patriarchal society. And I think that in the response that the girls provoked, that response exposes this sort of fear of women that definitely exists, and fear of female power.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Maxim Pozdorovkin, one of the co-directors of Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer. Now, Max, one of the things that came out, I mean, even reading this, is, and you know, I won't keep hitting at this, but it was really kind of made you jump back a little, you know, this idea of even with the clergy, the Russian clergy, describing these women as demons. You know, I mean, it was like there was a lot of like what really would not be a large leap into life-threatening name-calling, all these kinds of things that was actually, you know, calling for, in a certain way, a kind of cleansing of the society of these female demons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's two, I think that that's very true. And in a way, they were thought of as witches. And what happened was, especially amongst the religious fundamentalists really saw them in colors that are reminiscent of witch trials of the Inquisition and all these things. I mean, one footnote that should be made is that Russian Orthodoxy, unlike Western Christianity, tends to be a little bit more pagan. And so the idea of being possessed and objects being possessed by demons is less far-fetched. I mean, the idea is far-fetched, but it's more common to describe things and to describe sin and all these things in these terms. So I think that really came out as well. Mm-hmm. In a way, Dostoevsky's novel is that.
Yeah, you know, one of the things too that really stands out is in what I've read about it and what I've read about the movement is there's kind of a very refreshing, I have to say, in terms of what's going on in the world today, a very refreshing, no sort of waffling around, but a very refreshing anti-capitalism bent to a lot of what's going on with Pussy Riot. Is that true?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that the girls are against, you know, they're anti-commodification. They don't want their art to be sold. They want it to be freely available. And also, I mean, I think that I know from speaking to the parents and then to Katya since then, that I think that a lot of their kind of formation as political citizens and a came in the 90s when there is this sort of bourgeois takeover of Russia and during the neoliberal policies of the 90s. And so I think that what's interesting about it is that they are a genuinely left movement that's responding to in part, and they're responding to kind of the authoritarian tendencies on Putin's part, but also responding to a certain kind of corporate structure and oligarchical structure that came into being as a result of the neoliberal policies of the early 90s, of the Yeltsin years, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving on, I want to jump into this. You know, it was funny because when I saw the film at Sundance, you introduced it and you said, as you were closing down your introduction, you said, get ready for a lot of noise, a lot of loud music, and just full-on punk. Hope you like it. And, you know, I, as I was looking at the film and thinking about it later, the influence of punk, not only on the movement, but including in the way that you even approached making the film. And I thought that was captured in the one sister that was up on the stage with you when you got the award for the special jury award for Best Punk Spirit, when she said, kill all sexist, free Pussy Riot. And I thought that coming out of the movement and that whole in-your-face kind of thing permeates the film. How did you come about that? Because you were tasked with both, in your own sense of what you wanted to do, with both portraying this movement, bringing it out to the world, and in a certain sense to Russia as well, bringing it out. And at the same time, you, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, but I want to concentrate on that aspect first. At the same time, though, you were also telling a very personal story. So let's talk about that and the influence of punk, even in your conceptualizing of the film and making of the film.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, stories like this don't really come around every day. And especially because for me, in addition to being Russian and growing up in Moscow, I felt like I shared so many aesthetic kind of interests and tensions with the girls, and so I grew up listening to a lot of punk rock and also really loving a lot of the Russian avant-garde that very much influenced the aesthetic conception of Pussy Riot. And so from the very beginning, it was sort of making the film, for Mike and I, who are big fans of punk rock, was an excuse to really also give it a style that we love and that we really respond to. And both it's kind of, I think in the film there's a little bit of a constructivist edge, which speaks back to a lot of artists like Malevich and Rodchenko from the Soviet period. And then also there's just the spirit of DIY punk rock and editing that comes out of it. And also I should add that a lot of, the film shows several Pussy Riot performances from the past, and they're edited in this way. And so, you know, we were in a way following their lead.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Maxim Pozdorovkin, one of the co-directors of Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer. Now, Max, one thing that is also very striking is that in order to tell this story, you had to tell the big story, even as you situated that, made it the framework for the more personal story. In the big story, here you had this amazingly intense, as we've been talking about, repressive response to Pussy Riot and the concert in the church, and then generally what actually could be unleashed or symbolized by that movement. And you making a film about this had extraordinary access to, I mean, those scenes that you do of the trial with the three young women sitting in the cage, and you know, you're just, you know, it's just the repressive atmosphere, and it comes out and you learn so much. And I think there's actually a description of the film that says it raised for question what was on trial here, the three young women or the state itself. And to me, you know, it raised the question to me, is like, how the hell did you get access to that?
You know, I would love to be, it's funny because we got this question at almost every Q&A and after every screening about the legal troubles or anything or other kinds of troubles that we encountered from the Russian government. And I almost wish I had a story to tell about some sort of FSB agents knocking on my door, but it was actually quite easy. A lot of the trial was, the trial was filmed by the news agency, by like the Russian equivalent of Reuters, and we were able to obtain that footage. We're very lucky to obtain that footage. But I think that one of the things that the film, and why I wanted to really show essentially what the girls did when they were put on trial, and I think that they, in their own way, they turned the trial into a performance piece of sorts, and they stood by their political convictions and they voiced them. And I think that what it shows more than, I think that there has been a misrepresentation of the whole trial as a sort of thing that's orchestrated by one man at the top. And it's not, And I think that it's indeed a great deal more complex. And I think that what the film reveals is this excessively punitive nature of the Russian judicial system. It has a very high number of guilty verdicts and not enough innocent verdicts. It's actually, I think in Russia, it's about 90%. And the U.S. federal court's about 87%, I think, percent of guilty verdicts are given. So if the prosecution chooses to bring a case to trial, there's usually a guilty verdict and all these things. And so in many ways, the trial of these three women, while having this incredible attention, is in some ways not that atypical from most Russian trials. And I think that to me is, and you know, it's not uncommon for legal structures to be the last kind of government structures to reform. And I think that there's a lot of inheritance from the Soviet era, even in the idea of punishing hooliganism and nonviolent offenses with jail terms, that still persists in the Russian judicial system. And I think that I was fascinated by the trial itself, and that's why I wanted to stay in that courtroom and just show what it's actually like.
Mm-hmm.
Now luckily, we had the footage to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now let's dig into the other aspect of the story, which was in that framework, you really did a very moving portrayal of these three young women and, by extension, of the movement itself. Talk about that. How was it making that personal aspect of the film?
The personal aspect of the film, you mean the biographies of three women?
Yeah, and what you did in terms of the way, in the interviews, and the whole way you framed it, and the depth of information you got out. I mean, the interviews that you did with their family members. What emerges from there are these three young women who are not so much, you know, icons with no soul, but they are three very rebellious young women who are refusing to bow down to anything. But it's done in such, you do it in such a way that you see, you know, that really comes out. The humanity of these three young women really comes out in opposition to all the things that the barren, sterile courtroom, the frothing of the religious fanatics, all of this stuff. In the face of that, you have these three young women who really very much heart and soul, and their humanity really stands out huge.
Yeah, you know, I think that early on in the editing process, and when we were just amassing, we had a lot of material, and a lot of it was just sort of, there's a lot more political material and a lot more context about what's going on in Russia. And one of the things that I realized, Alan, is that once the balaclavas had been removed, you know, because Pussy Riot are an anonymous collective, but once the balaclavas had been removed from these three girls, or three women, rather, I immediately became, I mean, we all really wanted to know about them. And in a way, they became much more interesting. Once you hear their speeches in the courtroom, they become almost more interesting. They eclipse the movement itself in some ways, or they eclipse Pussy Riot a little bit. And so we were following that instinct. And also, you know, I think for me, one of the things is that because they were vilified in Russia to a great extent, I wanted to, by going into their biographies a little bit and showing where they're coming from, how they get to this movement, their past experience with performance art, all these other things, I wanted to actually show to Russian people, even to my family, and when it screens in Moscow, hopefully, that they're really nice people and they're well-spoken and they're patriots also in a very real sense. That they, even if people don't agree with the forms that they use, there are people that are committed to making their society and their country a better place. And you know, I think that that's something that has been a little bit lost in the way that they've been presented, either as martyrs or as sort of militant, you know, crude atheists. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, for me, the story is one of a generational conflict, and it's a new generation with new political ideas making itself heard by any means necessary.
We're talking with Max Pozdorovkin, co-director with Mike Lerner of the film Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Now, Max, one of the questions, just as you're speaking about that, it struck me, there's a big question that's just sitting there waiting to be asked, which is, you know, we talked about the response of the reactionary forces in Russia. You just talked about, in some way, you know, contextualize this in terms of a movement. What was the response, and even talking about generational, what was the response of the Russian youth to Pussy Riot and to the trial?
Well, for the most part, I mean, I think most people in Russia see Pussy Riot and what they did in negative terms. And so I think that they do have some sort of very fervent supporters, mostly in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And I suppose that group is growing. I think that once they were sentenced, there are a lot of people that felt like that the sentence was a little harsh. But there's still lots and lots of people that you meet that will say something like, well, maybe they shouldn't have gotten 2 years. They should have gotten a year. I think that part of the reason is because Orthodoxy has always had this meek role, so that and it's almost like these people have suffered enough and why you're trying to provoke them. So I think that there hasn't been that much support for them. But this is also, in part, the product of them being vilified on national television and presented them these really, you know, presenting what they did as a sort of national assault and an assassination attempt on the country's soul. These are direct quotes. So I think that there hasn't been much love, if you're just talking about sheer demographics in Russia, for them. But that changes a little.
Well, now you also showed one of the things that was one of the really dramatic moments in the film. You showed a huge demonstration that appeared to be in response to the sentencing. And where people were, there were women who wearing balaclavas climbing to the top of fences and, you know, and being chased by various security officials. Was there that kind of response to the sentencing in terms of a mass protesting response?
Yeah, there was a protest outside of a courtroom. It was not as large as predicted. And there was another rally, I think, 2 days afterwards. And also that was small. I mean, in general, the protest movement that really began about a year and a half ago, again, was the announcement of Putin's return, and there were several large-scale demonstrations. That has fizzled out a little bit. So there was, you know, a protest of several thousand people who gathered outside the courtroom to protest the sentencing, you know.
And
but it was smaller than the protest against them outside the cathedral.
That's interesting in terms of the polarization there. Now, one thing, you know, let's talk about the sentencing. You know, it was. So, I think for a lot of people, I don't know. I mean, it was very heavy because you're thinking this is a huge sentence. You know, they were facing 7 years, and okay, they got 2 years, but they're doing it in these remote prison colonies where, from what I've read, the conditions are really pretty bad. And you know, let's talk about that. One, were you surprised by the sentence? And two, what does it actually mean for this sentence to be doing the sentence? Give people a sense of what it means to be inside one of these colonies.
I remember standing there, or being in the courtroom on the 17th of August when they were sentenced. And for some reason, till the very end, I had this sense of dumb optimism that they would just get a suspended sentence, which didn't happen. And so I was, for some reason, very, very upset. I was surprised in a way, but most people were not. I think most people from the very beginning were expecting them to get a sentence, just because people that are usually charged with this article usually get between 2 and 5 years. And so, the colonies. Nadia is in a worse place. She's in a prison colony in Mordovia, which is one of the worst ones. I think Masha has also had some issues. With the staff and with certain kinds of regulations in her colony, which is apparently slightly better. The Russian prison colonies are scary places, and mm-hmm. probably wouldn't want to be in one. I think that there was kind of a secret interview with Nadia, which was recently filmed in the colony, and she seemed somewhat dejected. And it's funny, one of the things that they do is you can work and you get some sort of meager payment for it. And so they sew police coats and uniforms in the prison colonies. And she was objecting to the fact that it's sewing. So she wasn't against working in the penal colonies, but the fact that it was a gender-biased type of work.
Well, gender-biased, and I'd be willing to bet it also had something to do with you're sewing the uniforms for the people who are carrying out all the repression. It's kind of, whoa, that's a slap in the head. You know, one of the things I would ask you again is, and it's interesting to me because I know, just thinking about this, because, you know, one, look, there's the dungeons we have here in the U.S., you know, the solitary confinement for sometimes decades and decades, all the high security, maximum security prisons, all these things, the places where people are just dehumanized to the max in there, mm-hmm. you know, and it seems to me that this, wherever we are, wherever people end up in these things, that really one of the essential things is for people to actually know that there's people outside who have their back to the greatest degree possible. And I'm kind of thinking about this in relation to, you know, what you've been talking about. And, you know, one of the things is internationally, this became a major cause for a lot of major musicians and artists around the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. There's lots of support from, especially at the time, or during the trial, from Madonna, Paul McCartney, Elton John, Peter Gabriel, Faith No More, Fence Ferdinand, and the list goes on, and Yoko Ono. Mm-hmm. The list kind of goes on and on. No, I was going to say they really did become kind of a cause célèbre.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Maxime Pozdorovkin, one of the co-directors of Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer. And well, one thing that actually, again, now, and this goes back to some of the stuff that we were talking about in the beginning, one thing that happened was that there was, you know, there's this sense, and again, I'm just trying to wrestle with this thing of, you had something, and I think you guys have pointed it out in various interviews, that essentially, there's a sign outside the cathedral that tells you all the things you're not allowed to do, but these are all civil, you know, you would expect a civil penalty, you would expect a civil slap on the wrist, you know, in terms of the civil part of the government, as opposed to it became really a criminal issue and pushed into that realm, again, as a way of like, bam, it seems like there's something that they're trying to like stuff back into a box. I'm wondering if I'm, what you think of that.
I mean, I think that they wanted that, the criminalizing what they did is they really wanted a public spanking. And I think that they wanted that had the girls been just, you know, gotten on their knees and been really, really repentant, they probably could have gotten out of it. But they didn't do that, even though they did apologize and it wasn't their intent to offend believers. And I think that there's in general in former and post-Soviet countries there is a kind of this repressive tendency to punish civil disorder and civil disobedience. And I think that in this case, because there was enough of kind of a religious outcry and one could justify that there were people that were, you know, making death threats. Mm-hmm. In the movie, Masha's mom recalls receiving phone calls, making essentially death threats to her and to Masha, and to Masha's child. As a result, I mean, whereas before, when Pussy Riot performed other very well-known and kind of provocative actions, such as one on the Red Square, of Putin sits himself, they were always just given a fine. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, I think that, you know, one of the points I believe you and I discussed is that I think that there's a parallel with what happened with the government response to Pussy Riot. There's a parallel with the Occupy movement in this country, because at the end of the day, I think that the government tolerated the Occupy movement for some time, and then coordinated a crackdown on it, siding with essentially conservative corporate interests. And here, again, in the case of Pussy Riot, rather than stand up for secular principles, the government saw an advantage in punishing these women and essentially criminalizing blasphemy and punishing them and charging them with what is essentially hate crime.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say one thing that in terms of inspiring people all over the world, and this is going to have to be the last thing I'll ask you to comment on, but in terms mm-hmm. of inspiring people all over the world, regardless of, I mean, I, you know, believe me, I understand the situation of, you know, I understand that Nadia actually has now been hospitalized and that Masha is mm-hmm. actually under constant assault, it seems. I mean, there was a period where she was living, yep. you know, totally segregated off from everybody else, and that there were what she thought were actually people, other prisoners who were agents of the system that were actually threatening her. You know, there's all this thing. But I thought that the point that was made in a comment that Nadia made when she was interviewed in that colony, she said that she regretted nothing that she's done. And she made this quote that said, "If you're afraid of wolves, you shouldn't go into the forest. I'm not afraid of wolves." What do you think that captures in relation to Pussy Riot?
I think it captures something about Nadia and the fact that the kind of political art that she has been doing and she has been participating in for a really long time. They have a very sober understanding of what kind of consequences that it can lead to, and I think that they were prepared for it. I mean, I think one of the things that we try to capture in the film also is that they weren't really these naive girls who just had no idea what they were dealing with. I mean, I think that they did make a mistake in some ways, that they didn't mean to provoke the people that they provoked with this particular action. But they know what they're dealing with, and they know that they're involved in oppositional art that's largely unpopular and a lot of times receives political, kind of harsh political responses, and they're willing to stand up for their beliefs and stand up for their right to their belief that they have the right to do this kind of art. And in a way, I think that's what it reveals, and they're living through it now.
All right, Max, thank you very much for joining us today. And I'll let people know that the film is going to be on HBO, you said in May, something like that?
I think in June, yeah.
In June. Okay, so people can watch for it on HBO in June, and it will have a theatrical release, so check that out as well. Max, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Max Pozdorovkin, co-director of the film Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer. We are going to take a very quick break, a musical break, and come right back to talk with David Clennon about Torture, Zero Dark Thirty, and the necessity of standing up against all of this immoral and repulsive stuff that's going on around us. So stay tuned.
I want to hear your thoughts, see it all, like a heated web through the walls. You want to go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those eyes. There is a rose now, dance tonight.
All right, welcome back. That's Outer National with Here is the Rose and a special announcement. That song was put out by Outer National and posted up for a free download. It's part of it's announcing the Here is the Rose EP that's in conjunction with 1 Billion Rising's call for women to strike, dance, and rise. And each of the four songs on this EP will be available for a free download every Thursday leading to the EP release on March 8th, International Women's Day. And you can get that, and I'm just going to have to tell you, you're going to have to go just Google Here is the Rose and Outer National, and I'm sure you'll get the directions for how to reach it, all right? So don't miss it. It's a great song. All right, and right now there has been a huge, especially as we approach the Oscars and all the awards season for film and given the impact of that in the country as well as in Hollywood and the rest of it, and around the world, there's been a tremendously bad thing that's happened, and that is there's been a couple films, and one in particular, Zero Dark Thirty, which listeners know we've talked about on this show earlier, in terms of what the hell is concentrated up in that film and the need for people to stand up for that. But it's been getting, pinpointed for a lot of awards and a lot of talk about, it's a great film, a lot of different things going on. And there's been very few voices, at least in Hollywood, and I think overall there's been very few voices who have had the audacity and the courage to stand up against that. One of those voices is award-winning actor David Clennon. And he, as I said, he's been one of the few voices to take a stand against torture as promoted by the film. And David wrote that individuals and groups protesting the easy tolerance of torture in Zero Dark Thirty have been dismissed by some commentators as having a political agenda. The grievous problem presented by torture is not political, it's moral and it's criminal. And we're going to talk with David about all of that right now. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. So let's jump into this, man. What you just said about, what I just read from you about the need for people to stand up and do something and say something about this. What compelled you to stand up is one of those voices, the first and really practically the only voice for quite some time to stand up and say, no, this is wrong.
Well, one of the things we're talking about is the intersection of culture and politics, right? And in a parenthesis, I just want to say thanks for playing Creedence Clearwater Revival last week, Bad Moon on the Rise. An example of culture that you talked about in your youth that kind of energized you and added something to your life as a young person. Culture and politics, and culture can have a tremendous impact, I think, on politics. And to begin to answer your question, this for me goes back to the era of Fox Television's 24. Sure, a lot of people remember that show. It was hugely popular, and it promoted torture as a necessary, not a pleasant, not a pretty technique, but a necessary technique in the battle against terrorism, the counterterrorism unit that Kiefer Sutherland was involved with. And in my mind, Kiefer Sutherland became the poster boy for American torture. If you look at a book called Torture Team by Philip Sands, a British lawyer studying international human rights, you can see that the Jack Bauer character that Sutherland played had a tremendous impact, not only in the general population, but among people in the military and the intelligence community as well. They saw Jack Bauer as a model, as a hero, as somebody to emulate, as somebody to get ideas from. And I learned a lot about this from a really good journalist named Jane Mayer, who wrote a fine article in the New Yorker magazine around 2006, 2007, about 24, about the producers and the writers of the show and how they employed torture in the show. And that was a big wake-up for me. I didn't know the show very well, but shortly after I read that, I got an offer to do the show. And I told my agent I didn't want to do it because it promoted torture. And I got a call back from my agent later on saying that the producer, the writer-producer, the showrunner wanted to talk to me. Howard Gordon wanted to talk to me about the show and what they had in mind for me to do on the show. And I got into a long email correspondence with the guy, and we argued back and forth. And basically, he said torture is sometimes acceptable and necessary and effective in fighting terrorism or fighting the war on terror. And so that's how it began for me. I became aware that 24 had a huge influence on politics and U.S. foreign policy. You see what I mean? That mm-hmm. intersection of culture and politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We're talking with award-winning actor David Clennon about his courageous stand up against Zero Dark Thirty and its justification of torture. I wanted to talk with you about that, actually, because one of the things that you keep insisting on, and look, there's a lot of people ranging from Kate Bigelow, you know, Catherine Bigelow or Pigelow, as she's becoming known in many circles for what she's uh-huh. done. You know, this whole point about the idea that, wait a minute, it's a complicated issue here, you know, and I thought you've been and raising all kinds of questions, which I'll pose something a little bit later about. But you've been very clear around bull. It's torture, not right to glorify and sanitize war crimes. It's a crime against humanity. And to me, that's an extremely important point to constantly keep coming back to, because like you said, you turn something down and somebody's telling you, well, it's look, in different circumstances, you know, it's complicated. Sometimes you need it, sometimes you don't. But this is the whole point. And you've made a question because Bigelow has said that, you know, well, look, you know, it's depiction is not endorsement. And you've responded to that again, bull, and laid some stuff out about that. Let's talk about that a little.
Okay. So, yeah, that's her mantra. She keeps saying depiction is not endorsement, as though our problem is with depiction. I don't care if a filmmaker wants to try to stage a torture scene in a movie or on stage or on a television show. That's not the issue. That's a free speech matter, and I think that artists or craftspeople, filmmakers are entitled to do that. They're entitled to depict something that they think is necessary to tell their story. That is not in itself a problem. But the endorsement is a problem. It's not depiction equals endorsement. I would have the same problems with this film if she didn't have the torture scenes in it. If the torture scenes took place off screen, I would still have a problem because the movie shows a heroine as a torturer who actually murders a man through her practice of torture on him. And so she is a torturer and she's a cold-blooded murderer. And that's established in the 45th minute of the movie, and it's a 2.5-hour movie, and they continue to take you along with her, and you're supposed to be rooting for her. You're supposed to be cheering her on and hoping that she prevails in difficult circumstances and finally gets the bad guy. And there's something really wrong when you present a torturer who is, in fact, also a murderer. You present that person as someone to be admired, as someone to be cheered on. And that is my main objection. It's not depiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's how do you treat the subject of torture, not whether or not you depict it.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, here's the thing, David. You think about this, and I don't know if you read this piece Steve Cole did in the New York Review of Books, where he talked about one of the impacts of this film has been the widening of the debate around torture. And he said, look, here's the point. It's increasing this, on the one hand and on the other hand, form of argument around something that should be absolutely clear is a war crime and a crime against humanity. And he talks about when you're doing this, especially around the value of officially sanctioned torture, what that represents in that kind of relativism is a victory for all of those who would actually justify and promote and back up the use of torture.
Right. And I think it's a symptom of a level of depravity that we have sunk to. And you can put it in the context of imperialism. How do we treat the victims or the subjects of the American Empire? And the system of exploitation and the cruelty that goes along with that is horrible. But I think torture, for me, is the ultimate degradation, the ultimate exploitation and degradation of the human spirit. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. It's a complete dehumanizing of people. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we can say, yes, the system of capitalism exploits workers in this country. It throws a lot of people out of work, so they have to live as, without unemployment, live from day to day, struggling. There are horrors that capitalism inflicts on people here and abroad, and I think Lenin said, at home, capitalism wears its clothes, it wears a uniform, but abroad, Lenin said, it goes naked, it struts around naked and does terrible things that it couldn't get away with at home, in the home country. And again, I'll repeat myself, I think torture is the apotheosis. It's the extreme example of exploitation, and it's something that I think we all have to fight. And it's not really a political issue. This should not be the property of us on the left. It's a moral issue that should be claimed by the right and the center and the left. It's just so extreme and so degrading for all of us that I just don't understand why there isn't more of an outcry. But again, I come back to culture. We had 8 years of 24 promoting a culture of cruelty, and at the same time, there was a real cruelty taking place in the detention centers, in the black sites down in Guantanamo, and in fact, in prisons around the United States. There is a form of torture called solitary confinement. I think the culture has become used to it, and I thought we were going to turn it around. When Obama came into office and he signed his executive order forbidding torture, saying that the International Red Cross should be admitted to every single detention center to make sure that prisoners aren't being abused, I thought we were going to turn it around. But then Obama chickened out. He didn't want to prosecute any of the people who had practiced torture or who had authorized torture, talking about Cheney and Rumsfeld and company. He wasn't going to prosecute. He wanted to look ahead, don't look back, which I think is bull, because if you don't have a reckoning with the horrors that took place before Obama came to office, how can you really say that torture will never be a practice of the United States again, unless you actually bring people to justice for what they did?
Yeah, exactly. And you look at the situation now. I mean, even the fact that I believe that actually he's gone much further in terms of the repressive apparatus internationally and nationally than Bush ever did. And you look at the fact that Bagram still exists, that all these black sites still exist, that people are still being renditioned in Africa. They just had this exposure of all these people being picked up in I can't remember which country, whether it was Mali or whatever, that people were being picked up and they were being renditioned and disappeared, and then would turn up in a New York City courtroom 3 or 4 months later with nobody having any idea what had happened to them in those 3 or 4 months, you know, including the possibility of torture. We're talking with David Clennon about his stand against the justification of torture in Zero Dark Thirty and the effort to reward that with an Oscar this year. Now, here's a question to David, because what you're saying is extremely important, and it raises a question to me in relation to, you know, the response in Hollywood, for instance, around this, and the fact, this point about complicity, because I think you've made a lot of points talking today and also in some of the things that you've written about complicity. And really, all it takes to be complicit in something like this is to do or say nothing. And to me, there's just too much, there's just way too much, a deafening silence in response to this film. What's the response been in Hollywood to what you've been doing? And what do you think about this point about all it takes to be complicit is to do or say nothing?
Right. And I think Martin Luther King made that point, too, that one of the greatest evils is not so much. There are great evils done in this world. But King said that not to call it out and not to name it and not to speak the truth, the power in those cases is also a crime, and a crime against humanity. And another point that I would like to make too is that it doesn't matter whether you're an actor or a film editor or director, writer, you are responsible. You share responsibility for the end product. And if the end product is something that condones torture, that encourages you to approve or accept of torture, then I think as an actor in such a movie or television show, I would be guilty of promoting torture. If you like, in legal terms, I would be an accessory to torture, because what I was doing would encourage other people to practice torture, and it would create a climate in which torture would be accepted and would be tolerated, and torturers would never have to face the consequences of their acts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important, and I haven't had a lot of time to really take the temperature of the Hollywood community. I know Ed Asner has spoken out very forcefully against the film and against its promotion of torture. Michael Moore came up with a weird defense of the movie, which I thought was very strange. I don't know whether he felt he had to curry favor with the Hollywood establishment in order to finance his movies or get them distributed, but you know, he claimed that it was an anti-torture film, and I took him to task for that.
And I thought that was an extremely important piece. And I have to say, just real quick on that, with that Michael Moore thing, I think that's a living example of what's happening to far too many people who once considered themselves progressive liberals. They have this weird, as Bob Avakian said, they have this weird kind of Oedipal complex where they're not that they want to sleep with their mother, but they're willfully blinding themselves to the reality that they're living in. This is, you know, when I read Moore's piece and I read your response to it, I thought, you hit it right on the money. It was just right on the head. It was like, this is what's going on. David, we're going to have to wrap this up real quick, but just real quick, Riefenstahl and Griffith, and in relation to that, what this film could turn people into. You know, that's one of the concerns a friend of mine raised, is that said that they were very worried about what this film could turn people into. You raised Lenny Riefenstahl and D.W. Griffith. Can you say something about that in a minute or less?
Okay. One of the supposedly greatest cinematic achievements of all time was Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation was a deeply racist film, and it led to the revival of the Ku Klux Klan. It led to a revival of Jim Crow. I would say that film literally cost dozens of lives, because people were, I think, very likely lynched, who would not have been lynched if it had not been for that movie. Lenny Riefenstahl, great shooter, great filmmaker, but she used her skills, her art, to promote Nazism. So, you know, I don't care how crafty or how well made a film is. If it's the message is immoral, then you have to condemn it. It's a work of evil genius. And your slip of the tongue a little earlier was right. You slipped and said reward, award. What we're talking about is, don't reward this film with an Academy Award, because the people of the world will see that as another sign of continued depravity, frankly, on our part. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely,
you said reward,
David.
And then you corrected yourself. You said award. Don't reward this film.
All right, David. Thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll talk to you again soon. All right, take
good
care
talk now. With you, Michael.
You too, man.
Take
bye
care.
Now. We've been talking with award-winning actor David Clennon about his effort to stand up and expose and oppose all of the sanitizing of torture that's concentrated up in the film Zero Dark Thirty, and the effort to reward it with an Oscar this year. Well, that brings us to the end of another show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson. And I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going out now with Sonny Meadows and his song, Just Like Germany Before the War.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war.